When you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Harvey Ryder. I'm here appearing on behalf of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, Turlock Irrigation District, and the Transmission Agency of Northern California. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Bonneville Power Administration concluded that it needed to nearly triple the rates for transmission service on its southern intertie because, unlike its prior case only 2 years earlier, where it had rejected a proposal to increase the rates by roughly the same amount, circumstances had changed, and now hourly service had become a cheaper substitute for long-term firm service, and that customers, given the choice, would flock from long-term firm service to the cheaper hourly service, putting at risk its recovery of what had historically been 95% of its cost being recovered through those long-term contracts. The principal problem in this case is that the premise for the agency's decision that hourly service had actually become a cheaper substitute for long-term firm service is contradicted by admissions by the agency staff and statements by the agency itself that the agency either ignores or glosses over.
But we're not finders of fact here. Our job is to see whether substantial evidence supported the FERC decision, which is to say the agency decision. And maybe there's inconsistent statements, and maybe they said some things that a finder of fact might credit or not credit. But as I read this record, in 2016, when this proposal was made, the agency said it's not a terrible idea, but we don't have enough evidence yet to implement it. We'll study it. And they went out in the field and had hearings and did studies, and they came back with what appears to be evidence that the current structure was driving people away from the long-term transmission contracts, and therefore they wanted to raise the rate of the hourly one. But just assuming that, if that's the case, would that be sufficient substantial evidence?
Well, if it is the case
and it's enough, tell me why it's not the case here.
Well, if that was in fact the case, that there was, that customers were really going to flock to long-term firm service, that would justify doing something. But the agency had an obvious solution to that problem, so let me talk about that first.
Well, but let's just start out with what I asked.
Yeah.
Let's assume, would that be substantial evidence that would support some rate increase?
Not necessarily.
No?
It would be substantial evidence to do something. And the agency had, according to the agency, that there's what both parties have described as the seams issue, that at the border between California and the Pacific Northwest, there were differences in the way schedules are made, and that it was at least theoretically possible, it's been that way since 2008, theoretically possible that someone with an hourly service contract might be able to jump the line and sell power it had into California ahead of someone with long-term firm service. So there was an obvious fix to that problem. That's what they said causes this risk.
Are they required by law to solve it in a different way?
They are required by law to set rates that are the lowest possible rates.
And that's good. You got me to the question I wanted to ask. I don't find anything in this record suggesting that you raised that issue to FERC.
We raised it at FERC, but the issue was whether we raised the issue before the Bonneville Power.
Did you?
Yes, I think we certainly did.
The agency certainly didn't address it.
Well, they did. If you look at the very last sentence of their opinion, they make the determination that our rates are the lowest possible rates consistent with sound business principles, both for transmission and power services. So they certainly thought they were addressing it. They addressed the standards at the beginning of the decision.
Did you all raise it?
Yes, we
where,
said that.
Where?
The, well, what we said
where,
was that.
Where?
Excuse me. Bear with me just a second.
Well, you can tell me on your rebuttal, but I would like to know that.
Yeah.
BPA also states that your client did not participate in the public process regarding the rate making after 2016. Is this true? And if so, why didn't you?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't typically participate in Bonneville proceedings, so we were not intimately familiar with the process. But that was a pre-rate case workshop. There were 6 months of proceedings even after that workshop where we did file comments, and we were told that it's too late for you to consider those comments about alternatives then, even though they hadn't filed their rate case yet.
See, but there's two separate issues here. So one is whether you preserve the argument that they didn't consider other alternatives. But there's a separate question of whether you preserve the argument that the rates weren't the lowest possible ones. And so did you preserve that argument?
Yes, I think we did, Your Honor.
Where?
Again, if I can...
See, I know you made a 16-3-838G argument that they should have... You made the argument that they should have considered non-rate alternatives.
Yes.
But I don't see... You know, normally when you're arguing that rates are too high, you say it should have been lower. It should have been this number. What you basically said was they shouldn't have raised rates at all because they should have looked at non-cost.
Yes, that there was a way to solve their problem without raising the rates, that there was a lower cost alternative.
But we're not dealing here with an attack on the amount of the raise, are we?
On the amount of the raise?
Your contention is they shouldn't have raised them at all.
Our argument was that I think it was a little more nuanced than that. They said...
Tell me where Jordan McGee asked the same question. Tell me where the nuance appears in your arguments to the BPA. I thought the argument there was you shouldn't have raised rates at all. You should have done something different.
Well, essentially that's right, Your Honor. But we did say, and again, I want to emphasize that you only get to this lowest reasonable cost argument if you conclude that there was actually substantial evidence that hourly service had become a cheaper substitute for long-term firm service. And again, here, I think you look at what the agency staff said. Now, I don't think you can have substantial evidence when the agency contradicts itself.
Why not? What if the agency says, some of our people say this, I'm not sure that's what this record shows, but let me just ask it. Some of our people say that. We believe the people who say that, and
but
therefore we're
they didn't
moving
say
forward.
That. They didn't say, well, we considered this statement and we didn't.
Well, but the contradictions can't, the mere contradictions in their record can't mean that there isn't substantial evidence.
But the substantial evidence test, as the Supreme Court said in Consolidated Edison versus NLRB, says that you have to take into account that which fairly detracts from the evidence on which you rely. And they don't square their decision with a couple of key things, including their own findings. So one thing the staff was asked, the staff's theory was, well, when customers have the choice, they're going to choose the service that they find most valuable. And we pointed out that the customers were continuing to renew, and the staff's answer, and critical answer, was that they conceded that reflected the fact that even at the lower hourly rate that was then in effect, customers continued to think that long-term firm service was more valuable. That's why they were renewing. The agency itself in the BP-16 case had said that customers that rely on hourly non-firm often cannot obtain it during times of high demand because capacity is being scheduled by customers with long-term firm service. That fact is unchanged. The staff acknowledged in this case that it is during the highest periods of demand that customers who seek service using hourly service are most likely to get refused. Those are the hours that are most important and the ones where the companies make their money. Companies have power supplies that they can sell into California. When the demand is highest, whether it was in the evening hours or some other part of the day when it got hottest, that's when demand for electricity is highest and when the cost of producing it in California or Arizona or Nevada is highest and when cheaper hydro can be sold at a high profit. That's when they make their money. The reason that customers' renewal rates for long-term firm service have been persistently high is what the agency itself said, what it said in that case and what it's said in this case. That's when the service is refused. They've said that at ER 189 that the Southern Energy is one of the most valuable assets in the West Coast energy market. And they've said it at ER 119 and 184 that it's during these highest peak hours when the access is most valuable. That's also when it's most risky to rely on an hourly service.
Mr. Ryder, can I ask you, it appears that BPA evaluated the non-rate alternatives to raising the hourly rates in the white paper. And so my question for you, is this enough or why isn't this enough under the arbitrary and capricious standard of review?
That they I'm sorry, I don't quite understand
that
the
they
question,
discussed
Your Honor.
This. They talked, they evaluated this in the white paper.
Well, what they said in at hearing was that they didn't rank those alternatives, and they said we plan to look at non-rate alternatives after this case is over. So if they'd actually done the evaluation, a statement like that would have made no sense at all. They said we'll look at it after the case is over. Again, we only get to that issue if we conclude that there was a rational reason to think that the hourly service had now actually become a substitute.
So you're essentially making an insufficiency of the evidence argument, aren't you?
Well, it's the absence of substantial evidence.
Well, the absence or insufficiency. What you're essentially saying is that notwithstanding. Notwithstanding the BPA's agency's conclusion that there was sufficient evidence to support the notion that they needed higher hourly rates, you think there wasn't enough evidence from which a rational finder of fact could find that, right?
I think that's right. And in fact, Your Honor, this case is similar to a case that you decided in Village of Cake versus Department of Agriculture. There we had a situation, the risk assessment flipped.
Wow, I remember that case. That was a case that dealt with whether an agency could undo a previous regulation without making a new record.
Yes.
You think that pertains to this?
I think it does, because what happened in that case was the applicants sought a waiver of the roadless rule, and the agency had previously found that putting roads through the Tongass Forest would create a substantial risk to the environment.
Here the agency said in 2016, this might be a good idea. Let us study it.
Well, they didn't say it might be a good idea, Your Honor.
They went out and made a study, and whether the study's insufficient is a separate issue. What happened in the Village of Cake case is, one, the agency said, no, we're going to have this roadless roads rule. And then the new agency came in and said, no, we just changed our mind. We're just going to change it.
Yes.
No new record, no study in the meantime, no evidence, no hearings. Just changed it.
But
it's not your best case.
No, but the critical fact, as you said in the case, the critical decision rested on this assessment of risk. The critical basis for the agency's rejection of the hourly rate increase in the BP-16 case was the fact that it was an inferior service, that hourly, non-firm hourly customers were often denied service. That fact hasn't changed. That's why the service is inferior. It's sort of rate-making 101 that we discussed in citing the Fort Pierce versus FERC case, that hourly service is inherently inferior. Non-firm service, by definition, can be denied. That underlying fact hasn't changed, and neither have the overt manifestations of that inferiority. The customers continue to renew. The long-term renewal rate, which the agency points to, hasn't really changed. They offer two, in fact, conflicting statements about non-renewals. First, they say that the reason that the renewals were high were high because we promised to act on seams. They actually didn't act to fix the seams issue. And they said, we have a troubling concern about a troubling trend of non-renewals. They claim both that their promise to act on seams, which they themselves characterized as speculation, their staff characterized as speculation, they say that put a halt to non-renewals. And then they say, well, we're still worried about this troubling trend because of this one partial renewal by PowerX. The agency dismisses the only reference they actually make to the inferiority of hourly service is to say, well, in this case, we found that hourly service is available most of the time. I don't think if asked today, they would tell you that that's any different from what's always been the case for hourly service.
I'm looking at 146 of the BPA decision. I'm trying to figure out 172 of the ER. And the agency says, yeah, they got good renewal rates. But one reason they did was they went out to their biggest customers in 2016 and said, we're going to address this issue.
Yeah.
And it was based on that promise to do precisely what they did in 2018, the agency finds led to that renewal rate.
And the agency itself describes that as speculation. They say we can't know what the customers are thinking. Their own staff said we can't know what the customers are thinking. And what we do know are these facts. We know that at the time the customers made the decision, Bonneville concedes that the customers didn't know what action Bonneville would take. They also concede that at the time customers executed these multi-year contracts, they knew they'd be stuck with those contracts for the duration, whatever the agency did in the case. Those are the objective facts from which we know what happened. And I come back to what the staff itself said. The agency staff said that the reason customers were renewing was because hourly service was inferior. They valued long-term firm service higher, and even though the hourly rate was lower than it is now, this was before the rate increase.
What do you do with the agency's finding that this was justified by a decline in the queue?
Well, Your Honor, again, the agency's offered a variety of explanations. They said first, their staff says that the queue declined.
I'm not interested in what their staff said.
Yeah.
I'm interested in what the finding in the record is, which is that the decline in the queue was a good reason to do this. Was there a decline in the queue?
Yes, of course there was a decline in the queue, and there was also an increase toward the end of the case in the queue of about 300 megawatts. The queue had gone up from the time the market rules went into effect in California. It nearly tripled, then it went down, then it went slightly up again.
So they're looking at it when they're saying we would like to avoid further declines in the queue.
And
can't they raise rates for that reason?
It's one thing to take reasonable precautions, it's otherwise to take irrational precautions. And that's what they've done here. The agency itself has described this asset as one of the most valuable assets in the West Coast market. And they acknowledged that hourly service is still, that long-term firm service is still highly valuable in those peak hours of the day. That's when they make their money. It's like the good humor salesman who makes his money, and he may have to lease a truck for a year, but he makes his money during those summer months when people are buying ice cream. That's why people hang on to long-term firm service. And the agency never really comes to grips with that. The queue itself, if you look at what's happened to the queue, there was a 500 megawatt decline related solely to 8 megawatts of capacity. The line was almost completely subscribed. And under their rules, the way they calculate the queue, you had customers who held 500 megawatts of capacity declined to take 8 megawatts. That turned into a 500-megawatt decline in the queue. Now, we don't know, and they don't know, because they didn't ask why customers left the queue, but the way they structure the queue leads to a decline related to only 8 megawatts of 500 megawatts without any knowledge of whether those customers might still be interested in the service. We would be speculating, and that's what they're doing.
Did you want to reserve some of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. We would urge you to vacate that portion of the decision that raises the rates for hourly service on the Southern Intertie.
May it please the Court, my name is Courtney Olive, representing Respondent Bonneville Power Administration. This case concerns a Bonneville transmission rate increase that was broadly supported. Bonneville thoroughly explained its decision in a lengthy record of decision and addressed every one of the arguments that petitioners raised in over 50 pages devoted to their issues.
Did you say nominal?
No.
Oh.
Bonneville.
Oh, okay. I just
Excuse
to
me,
make
Bonneville
sure.
Power Administration.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. No, we recognize it was not a nominal increase, certainly not. I plan to talk about three things today. First, the substantial evidence that Your Honors will find in the record to support this rate increase. Second, the reasons why Bonneville acted in 2018 and not in the prior rate case. And finally, the lowest possible rates argument that petitioners are now raising but was not raised below.
Maybe you could just start with that because I think it's one that I... So I understand that what they said below was you didn't sufficiently consider non-rate alternatives.
That's correct.
And they preserved that argument.
That was a policy argument that they made.
Right.
We like these non-rate alternatives better than raising the rate.
Right, but that's not an argument being made to us, is it? That non-rate alternatives should have been considered.
Well, as I understand the argument that is...
Because I thought the argument was this one, the change wasn't supported by substantial evidence, number one. Number two, you didn't sufficiently explain your change of decision for 2016.
That's right.
And three, lowest possible rates.
Those are their three arguments.
Assuming lowest possible rates wasn't preserved, do we consider whether you sufficiently considered non-rate alternatives?
Well, no. Bonneville rate cases are about setting rates. So we had to have a starting point somewhere. So after, as Your Honor recognized, we were presented with these issues in 2016. In that rate case, we said exactly as Your Honor described. Well, this might be a good idea. These are serious issues, and they must be addressed. We launched the public process in which we considered the non-rate alternatives as well as possible rate solutions. And then we said, okay, as a starting point for the rate case, which is where rates are set, not these non-rate, you know, anything under the sun alternatives, as our rate case starting point, this will be our initial proposal. We will.
And that's what I'm trying to figure out, how this plays into our review of a rate setting case.
It doesn't.
In other words, let's assume that you had considered no non-rate alternatives. You just said
that would be fine. That would be fine.
We refuse to consider non-rate alternatives.
We often go through rate adjustment proceedings without launching into a public process that considers, that puts on a sort of a menu of different options and non-rate alternatives.
And I know I'm taking you off track, but that's why I'm interested in that, because I didn't think the question of whether you'd sufficiently considered non-rate alternatives was an issue in front of us. I thought the only issue in front of us was whether or not the lowest possible rates
issue was raised. That is the issue.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your
Thank
Honor.
You.
That,
Thank
that
you
issue
for the detour.
These petitioners vigorously contested this rate below. They filed over 200 pages of legal briefing. Not once did they utter the phrase lowest possible rates consistent with sound business principles, much less cite the statutory provision, much less say that this non-rate alternative, because you didn't choose that, you've incurred some non-necessary expense, which they still don't identify what that might be, and therefore you violated lowest possible rates. Of course it is a general standard that applies to our rates, and of course our ROD established that the rates were set under that general standard of lowest possible rates.
The BPA stated that it would evaluate non-rate alternatives to raise the hourly transmission rates, and in the white paper, it appears that BPA did evaluate these non-rate alternatives, and so, but I'm not sure I understand why these alternatives were not viable.
Because, as the record of decision states, those non-rate alternatives would have required effectively the hourly rate to be made less available. We would have to make fewer sales under the hourly rate. We would have to hold it back, and making the rate less available, Bonneville decided, was worse than increasing the substantial increase that we had, increasing the rate. So Bonneville said, well, rather than that, let's try the rate alternative. Yes, we said in the white paper that a bundle of non-rates alternatives and the rate alternative would be, I mean, if you had to do a brute force, you know, absolute most effective, you know, sledgehammer solution to this, it would be non-rate alternatives plus a rate alternative. But let's try the rate alternative for now, and that way we can have a singular focus on how that is working and see how it is working. Mind you, the non-rate alternatives carried with them their own costs and their own implications that were in the tune of millions of dollars. So they too had costs as well. So Bonneville pursued the rates alternative through its statutorily established 7i rate making process and tabled effectively the non-rates alternatives.
And so, then going back to the lowest possible rates, if we were to consider this argument, I guess, and how do you respond? I mean, why was 170% appropriate versus 100%?
That's where we get into the fact that there's really no law to apply on this standard. It's not something where we can say, well, 170 is okay, maybe 120% would have been okay. The cases that we have cited to you, specifically the California Energy case and the two district court cases that came shortly after the Northwest Power Act came about, say that in this specific type of context, where you are allocating costs between rates, as we were doing, between the hourly rate and the long-term rate, and the customers that buy under each of those rates, lowest possible rates, consistent with sound business principles, provides the court no law to apply in that cost allocation.
Well, if we had a different record, we might have a law to apply, wouldn't we? I mean, if the other side had come in and said, we've worked through the numbers, and even accepting your facts, you can achieve this same, this exactly what you want to with 100.
Possibly, if they, I mean.
The problem here is that there's nobody has contended that some other rate would be the lowest possible rate.
Exactly, and nor has anyone contended what the so-called non-necessary expenses that we
are incurring.
But
if the agency had made a determination one way or the other that the other rate proposed is not the lowest possible rate, because we could review that for substantial evidence. The problem here is that there is no other alternative proposed rate. Their alternative, as I understand,
yes, and
as I understand it, was to keep the old rate.
Yes, and well, what makes this, it's not a weighing of two different rate possibilities to determine which one is the lowest possible. I mean, if that were all there were to it, of course, Bonneville would lose every time it never picked the lower number. It's simply an administrator's business discretion judgment that call that the statute sets forth. You know, this is not like the PNGC case that petitioners have cited, where Bonneville engaged in a contractual obligation to pay out money to a customer, and by paying out that $32 million, its other rates had to be increased to make up for it. So that was the court found, non-necessary expense that Bonneville entered to. It's not what we have here. All we have here are the typical cost allocations between rates, and in that setting, California Energy is very, very clear that there's simply no law to apply under lowest possible rates. If I may talk a bit about substantial evidence, because I think it's important here. As the court, of course, knows, this is only more than a mere scintilla. And when you're engaged in a highly technical matter as this, the court has said many times that we give substantial deference to Bonneville's findings. And you really, to be quite candid, while that standard applies, all these so-called conflicts in the record that petitioners have raised, if you look at those sites and you read the words that the witnesses say, each and every single time, there is no conflict, there is no agency changing of position, there is no broad speculation. Every last site that they have raised to you, if you look at it in context, in the record of decision where it appears, or in the witness's testimony, you will see that they were making either a generalized statement. For instance, Mr. Ryder talks about, oh, well, they admitted that the long-term rate is a highly valuable product. You know, the only statement there is a statement from a Bonneville witness saying, yeah, as a general matter, when a customer chooses to buy the long-term rate rather than the hourly rate, they're making a choice under their business practices and what's important to them as to what they value, as a general matter, sure. Yet here we have pages and pages of briefing based on that one generalized statement. The so-called speculation statement, this appears in our ROD, I believe it's at page ER-170. Well, this is Bonneville saying in the ROD, yeah, we're not mind readers. We can't say exactly what customers might do, but we've just given you two pages of discussion why we think the renewal rates are not reflective of what may happen in this upcoming rate case and the massive amount of contracts that are up for renewal, more than twice as many than were up for renewal 2 years prior. And we have half as many people waiting in this queue line. So we have an enormous risk that the agency is facing, and we can't sit around and wait for that risk to materialize before we do something about it. I mean, Bonneville's one of its most fundamental statutory directives is you must recover your costs. And so, like any prudent business, we were taking actions before the risk actually...
Well, if I understand Mr. Ryder's argument correctly, some of it is, goes like this. You may have had all these appropriate concerns, but the rate increase that you chose isn't rationally related to any of those concerns.
So that's that is his argument.
No evidence in the record it would.
That's his argument, but it's dead wrong.
I think he classified it as irrational precautions.
Okay. All right. So
I was kind to
what Mr. Ryder considers rational or irrational is not the test. It's the administrator's business judgment, and explained in the record that we have twice as many contracts up for renewal in this rate case, half as many people waiting in line. We have customers who have told us through the public process that we just finished that long term isn't as valuable as it used to be, and due to these seams issues and the increase in solar power in California, we can use hourly instead. The peak hour, Judge Hurwitz, to your point about, well, it wasn't really the right number. Yes, it was. It was exactly the right number because these rates are set under a formula that links the two, the hourly rate and the long-term rate together. And that's where this peak hour number comes in. So the principle is this. In long-term rate, if you are using if you buy that service, you are allowed to transmit power 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as much as you want, subject to some curtailment limitations. That's the benefit of buying that.
And the benefit from your end is you've got
a steady customer.
Exactly. You know at the beginning of the contract how much you're going to get paid.
Exactly, which is critical to our agency, and that's why we recover 95% of the costs under that long-term rate. We must have that stable, predictable cost recovery that those one to typically 5-year contracts provide us, whereas hourly comes and goes with the vagaries of the market and supply and demand, whether they want it or not. So, but back to my point of how the rates are related. So the principle is that, all right, hourly is, or long-term is priced at a certain amount because you can use it all the time. Hourly, if you are using it for the most valuable times, the so-called peak hours, you should be paying as much because that's the most precious time to use that transmission. You should be paying as much as a long-term customer. So for generations in the utility industry, the rates have been set in that way, not just Bonneville's, virtually all utility providers, so that if you're using it for those peak hours, which had been 80 hours a week, which is easy to figure out, okay, 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. People are awake, they're using power, that's the peak. If you're using it for those full 80 hours a week, the rate is set at a level that it will cost you just as much as if you had gotten long-term service because
And you reduced that to a fewer number of hours.
We reduced that to a fewer number of hours to reflect the realities of the California market that these transmission lines serve, where the peak had dropped to around 25 hours a week, and that was because of solar power. All of a sudden the sun comes up, you have no more peak in the middle of the day because you have all these solar generators providing power. And the peak gets compressed into the evening hours when the sun goes down from roughly 5 to 10 p.m.
And I take it follows that the rate in those peak hours then is higher than the rate was before.
Well, it's not that. It's that peak hour number gets plugged in.
Right, you need to make more money out of that peak hour number.
Yes, or if you were charging under the old setup, a customer who was being charged an hourly rate which said, well, if you're using it up to 80 hours, it's going to end up costing you as much as long-term. Well, all of a sudden they say, I don't care. I only need it for 25 hours to serve this California market because of these seams issues. Okay, so we needed to change the rate to reflect the fact that, oh my gosh, customers are able to now use the hourly rate for just those 25 hours, and it's not costing them nearly as much as it would for long-term service. So we're now going to recognize that change in peak, which was well established, not only our studies, but the California ISO's studies, recognize that 25-hour peak, change our number from the traditional 80-hour peak to the 25-hour peak, and simply plug it into the formula. That's our first argument. That's our cost allocation.
But I just want to understand this factually. That results in a higher per hour
Absolutely
rate for those hours.
That's what got us to the 170%. We didn't just say, I think 170% would be good. We plugged in the new peak number recognizing the reality of the shortened peak in California, and that's what you got, was the 170% increase. So if...
And just so that I understand it, and it is complex, and I apologize if this is obvious.
It was complex to me, believe me.
If one of the hourly customers was only going to buy non-peak hours, would their rates have gone up?
If they had bought less than 25 hours worth of hourly,
right,
their rates would not go up. It depends on how many hours worth of hourly they buy. Once they buy up to 25 hours worth, they're going to hit that same...
They're going to hit the increase.
Exactly.
But if they were buying less, they would not hit...
Correct.
Okay. I thought that was in the record, but I wasn't sure I could
understand it. I need to clear up several misstatements and misconceptions from the opening presentation. Right out of the gate, the notion that the increase in the 18 rate case was, quote, roughly the same amount in the increase, absolutely not. It was a $9 and, I believe, 56 cent increase. The one proposed before would have been about a $13 increase. That's a significant difference from the prior.
That was the one that was not adopted.
That was the one that was not adopted, correct, Your Honor. This notion that we had a public process and these petitioners tried to comment and the process ran some 6 months long. No. The process ended with the white paper, and they came in 6 months later and tried to submit comments. So there was no unfair cutting off of comments here. Mr. Ryder repeatedly says that the circumstances haven't changed about hourly rate being unavailable and therefore not a viable substitute. Wrong. His own witness is the one that testified at the agency level that hourly is available most of the time. And Bonneville then studied that and says, you know, his witness is actually probably underestimating how much hourly is available because he hasn't considered the fact that a customer could ask for hourly for 25 hours, and if that was denied, they could make another request for 24 hours and then 23 until they got their request granted. So he hasn't even considered that factor. So it's probably even more available than he says. And we know that customers weren't having a problem getting hourly because if they had been, the long-term customers who are allowed to resell long-term transmission would have been reselling long-term to them, and they weren't doing that. That only happened one time.
Are you required under the statutes to provide hourly service? In other words, could the agency opt only to have long-term contracts?
Bonneville has discretion as to what type of services are provided on the rates. So there are several. There are hourly. There are multi-day.
No, I understand, and you've promulgated.
But no, we are not required.
Promulgated regulations and
we are
policies.
Not required.
But my question is,
we are required to recover our costs.
So
that's
only
statutory transmission rate setting.
You could, consistent with the statute, just simply opt to provide only long-term contracts if that recovered your costs.
I suppose so, theoretically. If the market supported that and was interested in that.
I'm trying to figure out what your obligation is with respect to providing short-term service.
Our obligation is simply to recover the costs of our transmission. That's the one statutory rate-setting obligation at play here. There is one that says it's the same cost to federal and non-federal users, but that's not at issue here. Let's see. Oh, another perfect example of petitioners taking generalized statements out of context is Mr. Ryder says, well, the reason they renewed long-term is because they valued it as a highly valuable thing. Yeah, we don't contest that the line itself, the Southern Intertie, is highly valuable. The question is how to price the two services that we're dealing with here, long-term versus hourly rate. And where he says our witnesses said it was highly valuable and that customers' purchasing decisions prove it, well, sure, they said that as a general matter, that, you know, if you value long-term, you're going to buy that. So I see that I'm over time. I'll simply summarize by saying Bonneville had ample substantial evidence, both under the cost allocation argument between hourly and long-term and the peak number that drove that, and under the rate setting prediction and projection that it may not achieve cost recovery because customers were indicating that they may not renew long-term, and there were many long-term agreements up for renewal. And then petitioner's argument about lowest possible rates has, of course, been waived. Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of brief points. Counsel for Bonneville has said that we testified that hourly service is available most of the time. And, of course, that's true. That's not the point. Hourly service is available in the middle of the night. It's available in the winter when demand is lower. The point is that it may not be available during the peak periods when it's highly valuable. And that's why customers chose to renew their contracts and have for years and continue to renew their long-term firm contracts. The agency, in its decision at ER 157, says that SEAMS issues have made it feasible for customers to switch hourly service for long-term firm service, but it was the increased solar's effect on peak hours that made it economical. The problem with that statement is they had a fix. If they thought that was the case, then they could have made it more difficult for customers to purchase hourly service. They expressed a sudden solicitude in their final order for these customers. They said, well, if we actually restricted the availability of hourly service, which would in fact have fixed the SEAMS problem that caused people to bolt.
Well, but that's why I asked your friend the question. Is there failure to adopt non-rate alternatives in front of us in this rate case?
Yes, I think it is, Your Honor.
Why?
Bonneville says that they acknowledged that they addressed the issue. They weren't.
They acknowledged they addressed it. They also acknowledged they deferred some of them. My question is, does a rate decision become arbitrary and capricious because non-rate alternatives were not considered?
Yes.
What case do you cite for that?
Well, I think that the non-rate alternatives that would avoid the need for the rate increase are similar to incurring unnecessary expenses. And we've cited this court's decision citing the Johnson case from the Sixth Circuit that says incurring unnecessary expenses results in rates that are reasonable.
My problem is incurring unnecessary expenses is something that the business does, right? It incurs in the necessary. Here what they're saying is, look, they're not saying it, I'm saying it. There were non-rate alternatives we might have considered, but we can make more money if we don't use them here.
But that's not.
If that's true, let's assume that's just the blatant decision.
Yeah.
We've chosen to increase rates rather than consider non-rate alternatives because we want to recover our costs.
Recovery of cost would be legitimate, but to make more money would not be.
I'm having trouble finding an imperative, other than their internal policies, on the statute that they consider non-rate alternatives in a rate increase case. Tell me where that comes from.
I think that comes implicitly from the notion that if you can establish a lower rate using sound business judgment, and one of those would be to adopt a rate alternative, a non-rate alternative that fixes the problem you're trying to solve, and you don't do that, you're not using sound business judgment. You had a way to avoid the problem, and you ignored it. And the result was higher rates than were necessary. I think that's implicit in what they mean by lowest possible rates consistent with sound business judgment. That judgment includes taking into account
That's a lowest possible rates argument.
Yes.
Okay. Did you find where in the record you raised that lowest possible rate argument?
Yes, I think their brief at page 51 points out that we said that we preferred the non-rate alternatives to the rate increase Bonneville ultimately adopted. And I think that they've acknowledged that that's exactly what we did.
But that's the question I tried to ask you before. You really never went in and said there's a lower rate increase that you might adopt. What you said was you can't do a rate increase at all.
That's semantics, Your Honor. There is a lower
rate. Those are semantics. That's the only way we can
speak. There is a lower rate. The statute doesn't say the lowest rate increase possible.
I know.
It says the lowest rates possible.
My question.
And there was a lower rate.
No, we're speaking over each other. So
yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let me just add. My question is, you never said, well, you could have, there's a rate increase that might work, but it's not this one. What you said was you're not entitled to increase your rates at all, right?
What we said was it was unnecessary to raise your rates at all. They weren't the lowest possible rates.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryder, Mr. Olive, for your oral argument presentations here today. The case of Sacramento Municipal Utility District versus Bonneville Power Administration is now submitted.